From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you for doing so. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. I wish you'd take a look at it. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, National Public Radio is just the latest of a growing list of major media outlets to acknowledge a resurgent and increasingly organized religious left. Inspired by the way this administration is politicizing conservative Christian ideologies, NPR points to the birth of the Moral Majority Movement 40 years ago as the last time we've seen this kind of prophetic faith-based backlash. The White House press secretary, daughter of political religious right demagogue Mike Huckabee, took a patronizing swipe at freshman Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal proposal by suggesting climate issues should be left to a much, much higher authority. AOC fired back with verses from Scripture along with the comment, quote, "You shouldn't need a Bible to tell you to protect our planet, but it does anyway." And David Matheson, who's been called the intellectual godfather of ex-gay pseudotherapy, says he's now a gay man. For years, Matheson used his Mormon religion as justification for debunked and destructive practices for which he now, quote, unequivocally apologizes. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Four people were convicted on charges related to leaving food and water for migrant families near the Arizona-Mexico border. The four women, who were volunteers with a faith-based organization called No More Deaths.
Now would be a good time to pause and ask, who would Jesus have convicted for leaving food and water for desperate migrants near the border? And if that thought isn't compelling enough, this story also prompted a leading rabbi to share on social media hashtag living in Sodom. We'll get the thoughts of that rabbi, Jill Jacobs, on this week's show.
Are you aware that the 13 most common religions in the world, that the simplest foundation of every single one of these 13 most common religions is literally the golden rule?
Even as the times we live in are as contentious and divisive as any in recent memory, there are many inspiring initiatives to bring people together across differences and diversity. An example is the new book, Co-Human Harmony, Using Our Shared Humanity to Bridge Divides, and you'll meet the author, the Reverend Gudgeon Bergman. But first,
in her 2017 evaluation report, her commander wrote, quote, "She embodies the qualities the Navy seeks in its future leaders," and strongly recommended her for promotion. Last year, her commander wrote she ranked in the top 1% of her peers, and in the category of military bearing and appearance, she greatly exceeds standards. For Winters, that appearance has been hard-fought. She was born male.
The Supreme Court giving the go-ahead to the president's decree via Twitter that transgender members of our armed forces have got to go. I'm happy to welcome attorney, author, and activist Rabbi Jay Michelson back to State of Belief Radio. Thanks for being with us again. Jay, what exactly happened this week? What was the court's 5-4 decision?
Well, this was an interim decision about Trump's transgender ban. So there are three lawsuits that are proceeding about it. And the question was whether the ban can be implemented in the meantime. So early on, the district court had said, well, let's hold off on the ban for now while these lawsuits work their way through the courts. But this week, the Supreme Court overturned that, and so the ban can now go into effect immediately while the lawsuits proceed.
So does that ruling mean that it has less significance from the courts fully hearing a case on this issue in terms of precedent? Is it settled, or is it a hint of what it's going to be when it's settled? Does the Pentagon still have something to do with this? Is there going to be another ruling?
Sure. So this is just a hint, but it's a very, very good hint. So when the court rules like this, they don't provide, generally, they don't provide an opinion. So we don't really know exactly why they lifted the injunction and allowed the ban to go into place. But it's not hard to figure out why if you look at the documents in the case, and I do that in my article on the Daily Beast this week. Essentially, the government was saying the national security threat is so grave that we need to place the ban immediately. We can't wait until the lawsuits are resolved. And it seems as though the court agreed with that reasoning. The standard that's used is one of irreparable harm. Is there an irreparable harm? So folks on the trans side had said, well, yeah, the irreparable harm is if you discharge a bunch of soldiers who have done nothing wrong and who have been serving honorably in many cases for years. That's the harm. But the court sided with the government that said, well, the harm on the other side is this harm to national security. And the reason that that is so troubling is that we know the history of this particular ban, and we know that it actually has nothing to do with national security. Mm. It has to do with Trump seizing an aspect of his base, the right-wing Christian conservative part of his base. This was a policy that was announced by tweet. It was announced without any reasoning. There was no justification for national security. That was all invented later. So sure, a commission was created, and they found, surprise, surprise, that there was a national security risk of having trans people in the military. And that's, you know, that was, of course, preordained. But the court, as they did have done in other cases, really took the Trump administration at their word, as opposed to actually investigate these claims. They say it's about national security, therefore it is about national security, and we're going to let the ban go into effect. That's what's so troubling about this case.
We know who is losing in this ruling, certainly the 9,000 brave service members most directly affected. But as you're indicating, it goes much further than that.
It really does. And, you know, without exaggerating, this is a really troubling case for the rule of law, because this is one of many examples in which the Trump administration has just made stuff up. Right? They've made facts up to suit their opinions. As I say in the piece, the most egregious example of this is in the travel ban. Right? So candidate Trump said numerous times, we're going to ban Muslims from entering the country. That's unconstitutional. Can't do that. So later, as Trump said, they watered down the Muslim ban. They renamed it a travel ban. And anyone who reads the record knows that what they were doing was just, you know, putting lipstick on a pig. They were trying to make this Muslim ban look like something other than what it was. But the Supreme Court went with the lipstick rather than the pig. They said, well, you know, the State Department says that these seven countries pose security threats, and we take them at their word because that's their call to make. And so they allowed the Muslim ban, now the travel ban, to go into effect. This case is very similar. Here again, there was a prejudicial policy. There was a policy based on hatred, not based on reason, not based on any real rationale. It was announced by tweet, just like the Muslim ban was announced at a campaign rally. And the facts were made up later to suit that prejudice. And so this is the second time, and probably not the last time, that the Supreme Court has rubber-stamped a kind of fake rationale that was invented by the Trump administration. And, you know, when we think about some of the other big questions that are coming down the pike, so about Russia, let's say, or about the shutdown, about the border wall, you know, so the border wall right now, which has caused the government shutdown, that's another one. This is another policy that Trump just kind of created as a demagogue to win an election. He didn't do any research to find out what were the issues of border security. You know, we could spend a whole time just talking about that. He just made something up. He made up an image that he knew would work really well with our sort of more base instincts around nativism and nationalism and racism and fear. And he made it up. And now they're saying, well, it's so necessary for border security. But we know that's not why the border wall is being proposed. The border wall is being proposed because it's a red meat issue for the worst, most craven aspect of the Trump base.
Yeah.
So in issue after issue after issue, there are these. The Trump administration is making up facts to suit their prejudice. And if the Supreme Court continues to rubber stamp these, it's as exactly as you said, well, it's much more than the 9,000 service members who are losing. Really, democracy itself is losing.
Does this delegitimize transgender lives in ways that will be used by bigots and fearmongers beyond the armed forces?
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely true. And you know, first of all, serving in the armed forces is just a marker of citizenship. Like, are you a full and equal citizen or are you not?
Yeah.
And so even totally separate from any of the sort of reasons that were offered, it's just saying that trans people are second class citizens. And that in turn leads to, it trickles down, right? It trickles down to violence on the street. It trickles down to discrimination in the job market. And, you know, I've written kind of a series of articles now for the Daily Beast, so I've been focused on this issue a lot. What we're seeing is an effort to just delegitimize the concept of transgender itself. So never mind that there are a million people or so who are telling us this fact about their lives. Never mind that every scientific association, psychological association, recognizes what gender dysphoria is. It may be new to some people, but it's not really that new to science. So there are facts about what transgender is. But for the last 2 years, the government has been pushing a narrative that trans just doesn't exist. It's not a category. People are disturbed. They're mentally ill, or they need psychological counseling and to so that they won't feel transgender anymore. I mean, that doesn't work, right? We know exactly how to address transgender and gender dysphoria with competent doctors and whatever intervention is appropriate, whether it's hormones or surgery or other. And this isn't new science, but it's science being attacked and undermined. And so absolutely, this extends well beyond the military, and this just legitimizes everything from, again, violence on the street, discrimination in the job market, and this overall government initiative to just say that somehow that trans doesn't exist at all.
In your Daily Beast article, you wrote, "The trans ban isn't grounded in facts. It's grounded in a demagogue's tweet." Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, that's right. I mean, so this came out, as I said, this was policy by tweet. And this was just, again, some red meat thrown to the base. They wanted this, and they got it, and Trump gave it to them. And then the facts were made up later. And, you know, that really is terrifying. I mean, that is what demagogues do. It's what dictators do. It's, you know, pick your dictator from the 20th century, you know, Stalin, Hitler, whomever. You make facts up to appeal to fear and to appeal to prejudice. And, you know, look, for a lot of people, transgender is new. It challenges the fact that there are trans people in the world, challenges a lot of our assumptions about what gender is and what sex is. And I get it. I didn't grow up knowing what transgender meant.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that gender and sex were different things, that sex about the physical body and gender about one's self-conception and how one sees oneself. So it was new to me also. So I get that it's new to people. And, you know, what responsible leaders do in that kind of situation is try to help. You know, so when it came to lesbian and gay folks, you know, when President Obama sort of changed his mind on gay marriage, you know, he gave a couple of interviews in which he said, you know, I didn't grow up believing in same-sex marriage, but I got to know gay people and I got to understand more and come on this journey with me. I mean, that's why we're having this conversation on your radio show. This is a spiritual journey that we're invited on to open our hearts, to listen more to other people's experiences, and to open our minds as a result. That's what a responsible leader does when there's something new or threatening or scary to some people. They invite us on that kind of a journey.
Yeah.
And Trump has done the exact opposite. Rather than invite us on a journey, he's invited us to stick our heads in the sand, to build a wall against those brown people coming from Mexico, to keep out all those Muslim people coming, and here to devalue trans people and make up lies about how they might be bad for the military or bad for group cohesion. It's the exact opposite of responsible leadership, and it really is a form of demagoguery that should trouble any of us.
Should we worry that this aspect of the court's decision might portend for other administration policies that are divorced from science and evidence? Does this create a category of protected beliefs for this and future presidents that are somehow enough to base national policy on?
I think that's a real concern. So one example, maybe a more benign example, I suppose, depending on how you look at it, would be at environmental policy, the EPA. Scott Pruitt, the former EPA administrator, got a lot of press. His successor has been out of the press, but has been continuing the destruction of science at the Environmental Protection Agency. So they're making decisions not based on science, but based on what industry would like in terms of anything, pollution controls, anything else. So those come up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, if it rubber stamps those decisions, we could throw out much of environmental law as we know it, just by administrative rulemaking. It's true, as we mentioned, in the travel ban and the border wall. It's also true around Russia. If Trump wants to fire more people, he can make up reasons why he wants to fire Mueller and this investigation or whatever. And if the court rubber stamps his action rather than holds him accountable, well, that's a tremendous failure, right? That's and that the fate of the presidency could depend on that question. This footnote's a little bit for law geeks, so just permit me for this fun nerding out for the next minute. The two Trump appointees, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, are extremely conservative. We saw that how they voted in this case and in another case that came down at the same time. But they're also not fond of giving agencies a lot of discretion. So there may be a kind of twist in the story in which the particular kind of conservatism that Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch believe in may actually not let the Trump administration get away with all this stuff. We'll have to wait and see how seriously they take their principles. It's very possible that just ideology will trump principles, and this is something that conservatives want. They're afraid of transgender people. They're afraid of the breakdown of what they see as traditional morality and traditional gender roles. So maybe all that ideology will just override these justices' principles about limited government. But for that, we'll have to just wait and see.
Dr. J. Michelson is an attorney, author, and activist, as well as a rabbi and meditation teacher. His books include the best-selling God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, and The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. Jay's Daily Beast article is headlined, Supreme Court Accepts Trump's Word That Trans Troops Are Threat to National Security, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. I appreciate so much being with you today on State of Belief Radio.
It's my pleasure, and we need the religious left more than ever, so keep up the good work.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Rabbi Jill Jacobs will be back with us to talk about the scriptural lessons of Sodom and our southern border. And up next, the Reverend Gudjon Bergman. His new book is titled Co-Human Harmony, Using Our Sacred Humanity to Bridge Divides. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Published on this Martin Luther King Day, the book is titled Co-Human Harmony, Using Our Shared Humanity to Bridge Divides. The author is the Reverend Gudjon Bergman, founder and lead educator at the Harmony Interfaith Initiative, and I am really pleased to have him with us today on State of Belief Radio. Gudjon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
I want to start with the title of the book, Co-Human. Frankly, it's a new term for me, and I want you to explain it to all of us.
Well, on June 18th in 2017, I was sitting at a terminal in New Jersey, heading back home after becoming an ordained minister, and I was watching CNN, and Fareed Zakaria was on, and he had the peacemaker Padraig O'Malley, who was instrumental in the Northern Ireland peace process, on. And O'Malley talked about that every human being has two personas, the human and the ideological. And the real danger, he said, is that when we overuse ideological terms to describe each other, to talk about each other, then we dehumanize, knowingly or unknowingly. And so the idea with the book is to rehumanize, to co-humanize. And this was a term that really came out of my conversations with workshop attendees who really embraced the term co-human and found that it was a connective concept that they could take with them and really change the way they approached people who had differing ideologies.
Hmm. I know that you bring a lifetime of interfaith work to this book. I wish you'd talk about how you envision this bridging of divides working.
Well, one of the things that I struggled with for a long time was the achievable vision kind of concept. What is an achievable vision? What does it look like? Because pretty soon into this work, I realized that we're not all going to sit around a campfire and sing Kumbaya and be best friends, right? Mm. There's just too much diversity of thought and culture and all that in the world. So what is the best we can hope for? And there was a great analogy that I got from a workshop attendee. She lives in Boston, and she attends this Irish folk song ensemble every month. And it's all amateur musicians, and it's pretty chaotic because they usually don't use sheet music. And she said that the introduction of one or two really good musicians could have two effects. One was that people if the musicians were demanding of the group, then everybody would kind of back off, play less, participate less. But if the musicians were supportive and patient, then everybody played better, right? So it only took one or two good musicians added to the group. So that kind of gave me a vision for an achievable goal that bridge builders and harmonizers and healers can really use, is this idea that each person has a social connection, a really deep connection to about 40 to 120 people, maybe 160. So these are people that they trust, that they turn to in times of need, that they believe to be their friends and part family and all that. So the vision that I have is to introduce real strategies, tactics, ideas to one or two people per group of 40 to 120, and hopefully they will have this influence on their group of people that already trust them. Because what I've found is that standing outside of a group and trying to change their behavior and trying to get them to work with other people is really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And the more of an outsider you are, the less people listen to you, right? Mm-hmm. And so, getting inside the group with one or two willing participants. For example, I'm working with the Episcopal Diocese up in northern Michigan these days. And they're trying to reach out to the Native American community there. And the in is to find willing participants in the Native American community, which they have found, and start a dialogue with them. And then ask those Native Americans to reach out to other people and then bring them into the fold and then try to create a better system of communication between the two groups. Hmm. But it has to start from the inside. It's very painful often to look at people shout at each other from the opposite sides of ideological divides. Mm-hmm. And there's no sense of shared humanity, and there's no sense of willingness to even try to start bridging. And so my goal and our goal at Harmony is to work with the willing to support and supplement their work in any way we can.
there are, as you said, a lot of people simply who don't see any benefit in dealing with others that are different from them. I have the question of how we can help those people understand why there is a very real and very urgent need to reverse the trends toward divisiveness in our culture.
Well, you know, the first question I ask in the book is, who is seeking harmony?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is obvious. It's only people who feel acrimony, who feel discord, that say, hey, enough of that. I want something better. When life vibrates at a harmonious frequency, people usually don't want to change their behavior much at all. They just mm-hmm. go about their business as usual, right? And so, you know, pain is really the greatest motivator. And what I find is, and working with people, I had a workshop last year with about 300 participants from 25 countries. And all of them, you know, every single one came to the workshop because they were fed up, that they wanted something better, that they thought, you know what, I'm sick of this divisiveness. I'm sick of this, these chasms being created everywhere. I'm sick of the rhetoric here. I want something better. And they came to the course for solutions. And so those are the people that I'm talking about, sure. who are the willing.
Yeah.
And those exist within a diverse, diverse mm-hmm. groups. There were people there who would be called conservative, the people who were liberal, people who were minorities, people who were in the majority, everybody in between. Mm-hmm. But they were all agreed on this one thing, that enough is enough.
Sure.
And now we need to start working. Now, the majority of people are not there yet. And unfortunately, I think we're going to have to endure some more pain before people are willing to turn to something better. Hopefully it's not, the worst possible, increased violence and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But there are enough people, I feel, to start reaching out to who are the willing, who say, you know what, we can do better than this. And I'm going to work within my group to see if we can find more social harmony and build bridges where we can.
And Gujan, what are some of the prescriptions, principles you provide in this book for focusing on our shared humanity?
Well, I mean, first is just understanding between, the difference between the ideological and human personas. When I first heard the concept, I kind of shrugged and said, that's interesting, the human and ideological personas. And then my subconscious mind really, grabbed that idea and started to chew on it and work on it, because for the next 6 months, all I could see were the divisions were mostly between the ideological personas, whether that was online, in the media, in person. And when people really came together was when they were mostly focused on the human persona. For example, in natural disasters, everybody just has the basic human needs in natural disasters, and everybody pulls together. And it's a beautiful thing to see. And if we could bring some of that mentality into, interfaith work, inter-ideological work, inter-political work even, there would be much movement in the right direction, I feel. But second of all is, how do we get there? Is through human experiences. So I offer a variety of experiential events and gatherings that have worked in interfaith settings across the states. And then dialogue principles.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get together and talk, and how do we create trust? Because a lot of people, they start off by wanting to talk about the most divisive topics, and they've not created trust. They've not created a shared sense of humanity, and therefore their talks are destined to break down.
Mm-hmm.
Because first the trust is established, first there is a shared sense of humanity, and then we can have these difficult discussions. And my feeling is that a lot of people have lost this feeling of shared humanity and only see the others. The otherizing mm-hmm. is dramatic these days. Only see the others as the enemy, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we need to get back to this idea of co-humanizing, seeing the shared humanity. And there's a way to get there. It's long, it's hard, just like, you know, when trust has been lost in relationships, it takes time to rebuild that trust. Mm-hmm. But it's possible. And I've seen it happen, you know, just from personal experience, both in my own family and then in groups around me and then in larger context in the interfaith work. So it is possible to get there. And lastly, the stumbling block is when we demand harmony on the outside and are not working on it on the inside. So I provide several approaches to creating harmony from the inside out, mm-hmm. and talk about the stumbling blocks, the things that trip us up when we're trying to be good and do good, and how that can often, how our love for one thing, for example, can easily turn into hate or dislike of another thing.
The Reverend Gajon Bergman is founder and lead educator at the Harmony Interfaith Initiative and is the author of the new book, Co-Human Harmony, Using Our Shared Humanity to Bridge Divides. Gajon, I thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, sir.
The outrages just keep coming, fast and furious. Among the latest, four activists have been convicted of a crime after leaving food and water for migrants crossing our southern border. Rabbi Jill Jacobs, executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, took to social media to explain the connection between this latest outrage and the scriptural story of Sodom. And it prompted me to invite her to be back with us again on State of Belief Radio. Jill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Reverend Gaddy. It's good to be back here with you.
For anyone who might have missed it, what was the event that prompted your response?
There were some activists from the organization No More Deaths who were convicted because they were putting out food and water in the Arizona desert for people who are crossing the border under very, very dangerous conditions. And that's it's a very serious conviction that could lead to possibly 6 months of prison time.
My goodness. Isn't that hard to believe?
Absolutely. When we think about what it means to be religious in public space, often, unfortunately, we think about the ways in which people use religion only around certain issues, whether it's around abortion or whether it's around what rights LGBT people can't have. And often we think about people from the right who are acting out of religious convictions. But many of us who are trying to build a better and more just society that includes everybody equally are also acting out of our religious convictions. And certainly it is absolutely clear from all of our religious texts, all of our sacred scriptures, that one of our primary responsibilities is to provide for those who are needy, who are vulnerable, for immigrants, refugees in our own communities, which is exactly what the activists from No More Deaths were doing, some very clearly and vocally out of their own religious convictions, putting out water for people who are undertaking this extremely dangerous trek, and who unfortunately there are many, many people who have died in the desert because of the heat, because of lack of food and water, mm-hmm. and this group is trying to save lives, and that is something that should be celebrated, not something for which one should be convicted.
You used the hashtag living in Sodom. Why did you do that?
Well, according to Jewish interpretations of the sin of what we would call Sodom or Sodom in English, the people of Sodom are punished because of their treatment of strangers. So there's lots of ideas out there in the world about what the sin of Sodom is, and I don't have to rehash those, but I'll just say that at least according to Jewish tradition, as well as clues inside of the Bible itself, they're punished because of their of their treatment of strangers who are coming into their city, and not because of what some of us have learned and mm-hmm. have heard. So even in the book of Ezekiel, it says really, really clearly, this is the sin of Sodom, arrogance. She and her daughters, so referring to the city as a female, had plenty of bread and untroubled tranquility, yet she did not support the poor and the needy. So that's right there in the Bible, in the book of Ezekiel. And in the Talmud and in Midrash, which is expansion of the biblical text by the early rabbis, they make it even more clear. So the Talmud, for example, says that the people in Sodom were worried that wayfarers, anybody who's passing through, was just going to come to steal their wealth. They said to each other, oh, we have so much wealth, and there's no reason for people to come except to try to steal that, so we're going to make a rule that says that nobody can come through. There's stories about them, for example, that they would give out these coins to poor people or to strangers that had special mark on them that meant that nobody would accept them. So it looked like they were giving out tzedakah or charity to people, but actually people couldn't use those to buy anything because nobody would take them, and so the poor people would just die of hunger, and then the people of Sodom would come around and collect the coins and use them again. And the particular story that I mentioned in my initial tweet is a story that appears in a midrash called Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer that tells about one of the Lot, as we know from the biblical text, Lot left with two of his daughters, and there's some clues that suggest that maybe there was another child who didn't leave with them, just some linguistic ambiguities. And so the Midrash always steps into those places where it feels like there's a linguistic ambiguity and fills it in. And so the Midrash here says, well, there was actually another daughter, and that other daughter was married to some very wealthy guy in Sodom, and she noticed that there was a hungry person. And again, remembering that there's a law that the people of Sodom have made, according to this Midrash, that says that you're not allowed to feed anybody who's in need. So what she would do is every day when she would go out to gather water for her family, she would put some food from her home into her jug, and she would sneak it in there, and then she would go out and she would feed the person. And eventually, the people in Sodom look around and they say, why isn't this person dead yet? Mm. Who's been feeding him? And they eventually figure out that it's her, that she's been feeding him. And the law that they had made said that anybody who feeds somebody who is hungry will be burned, will be punished by being burned to death. So they take her out and they're burning her to death. And in that her dying moment, she calls out to God. And at that moment, God says, I'm going to go down and I'm going to check out what's going on. And if what she's saying is true, then I'm going to essentially turn over the city. It's in somewhat more florid language, but I'm going to flip everything upside down. And God punishes the people in the city because of this woman's dying prayer. Hmm. That's just one of many, many stories like that about Sodom. The Midrash also talks about the judges who passed evil laws against passersby, against wayfarers, travelers. The Talmud talks about the judges and names the judges with these names that mean liar, deceiver. These are judges who can't be trusted. And unfortunately, too much in America reflects this biblical picture, at least as reflected through the interpretation of the early rabbis, as an evil city that is evil mm-hmm. because there are lying justices who are perverting justice, who are specifically perverting justice in such a way to make less justice for strangers, immigrants, sojourners. There are specific laws that are passed that try to close off the city that say, we're just going to protect what we have. The Midrash even says, the people of the city, they were safe from war, they had nothing to worry about, and yet they wanted to protect themselves, which of course is very resonant to the situation now. And unfortunately, to use horrible pictures of Sodom as described by the rabbis, we see very clear parallels to what's happening in our own society, laws that are passed that are making it more and more difficult for people to apply for asylum here when they're escaping their their homes in dangerous areas. They attempt to build a wall, which we don't need for protection, nor would it protect us. It's only going to make it more difficult for people who desperately need to come here, who want to apply for asylum here. The sense that we want to protect only some people in our society and not those who are the most vulnerable. The willingness for petty reasons to close the government for now more than a month, which is resulting in 800,000 government workers not getting paid, as well as so many people who are indirectly affected, either because they work on contracts for the government, because they run businesses, restaurants, food carts, etc., where government workers eat, whether it's airlines that are losing business. There's so many, probably millions of people who are being affected only because of this petty desire to keep out anybody who would want to come into our country. The reason that people think that homosexuality is in the story of Sodom is because the people of Sodom are asking for Lot to surrender the travelers, who, of course, are the angels who are staying with him, because they want to rape them. So it's not at all a story about loving partnership. Mm-hmm. It's not a story about a consensual relationship between two men or two women. It's a story about rape. So, of course, rape is wrong, whether you're talking about, no matter whether you're talking about a man raping another man, a man raping a woman, rape is wrong. And there's no reason to use that story of attempted rape to say anything at all about consensual relationships between two loving partners.
Mm-hmm. Do you find in your experiences in the Hebrew tradition what, sadly, I have to say I find in my Christian tradition, and that is that people read scriptures and claim to be very devoted to scriptures, and then they say, well, that's a very good text, and then don't do anything about it?
It for sure happens that people will have good intentions but not act. But actually what I'm really proud of is that TRUA, the organization that I lead, which is almost 17 years old. It predates my coming here as executive director. We now organize more than 2,000 rabbis and cantors and their communities across the U.S. and Canada to protect the human rights of all people. Mm-hmm. So that's more than 2,000 religious leaders, plus the many hundreds of thousands of people they work with every single day, who are working to protect the human rights of everybody, and particularly who have been showing up in extraordinary ways since the Trump administration's attack on immigrants, whether it's rabbis getting arrested en masse in response to the Muslim ban, or three delegations that we've sent of rabbis to the border to witness what's happening here, or rabbis in more than two dozen cities who organized protests with other faith partners and with their own communities over the summer to protest family separation, or 70 synagogues that are in a sanctuary network called Mikdash that we coordinate. So 70 synagogues that have said that their communities are committed to protecting immigrants who are at risk of deportation. So that's what I'm really proud of. This is not some marginal position in the Jewish community, and I don't actually think in most religious communities, but we have more than 2,000 rabbis who are standing up every single day for immigrants, for asylum seekers, for refugees, for others who are being attacked by the current administration.
I think we are seeing a lot of people who are willing to risk their personal safety to do what they see as right and just, and that is so heartwarming, and it's such a good model for the rest of our people.
Well, for the Jewish community, we all grew up with the stories of family members of our community or members of our community during the Holocaust. So we all grew up with those stories about people who took great risk to do the right thing in that moment when they were actually risking their lives. Thank God in America today, we're risking perhaps jail time, but we're not necessarily risking our lives for protecting immigrants and refugees. But we all grew up with those stories, and we all asked ourselves what we would have done. And now we're in a situation in which people who are coming to this country or trying to come to this country as asylum seekers, as refugees, just like many of our own families and our own community members did, are not being allowed to seek asylum, which we know is potentially fatal. Our community responds to that and has been stepping up, as have, of course, many Christian and Muslim and other faith communities.
Jill, tell our listeners about TROA and how they can get in touch with your organization and what they're doing and how they can get involved if they want to.
TROA mobilizes more than 2,000 rabbis and their communities to bring a moral voice to human rights in the U.S., in Canada, and also in Israel and the occupied territories. And the best way to learn about what we're doing and to get involved is to go to our website, which is www.truah.org. That's truah.org. And there you can download resources. You can sign up for our mailing list, which will get you action alerts and news about what's happening. You can see some of our programs, and you can find ways to get involved and also, of course, to support our work.
Rabbi Jill Jacobs is Executive Director of TROA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, and she's the author of the books Where Justice Dwells, a hands-on guide to doing social justice in your Jewish community, and There Shall Be No Needy, Pursuing Social Justice Through Jewish Law and Tradition. Jill, it's always great to talk with you, and I appreciate so much your prophetic voice in our nation and what you're doing through your organization. You're always welcome here on State of Belief Radio, and it was good to have you today.
Thank you. It was really good to be with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you. And I want to say thank you for myself and all of us here at this show. But I also want to say thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners who tell us how important this show is in their lives. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.